Okay, so on this topic about not giving a fuck about what people think about you, you wrote an op-ed for The Guardian titled, "Why Mothers Should Stop Feeling Guilty and Start Getting Angry." So did that, what you learned from writing that article, have anything to do with why you're calling this the Fuck Mom Guilt World Tour?
Totally. Guilt and anger operate in different parts of the brain. Guilt is an emotion that makes you quiet, makes you withdraw, it makes you not want to stand up for yourself. And anger is approach motivation. So it makes you energized, it makes you want to speak up, and it makes you want to move towards challenges. So, you know, we hear so much about mom guilt, and I think we're very comfortable as a society with mothers feeling guilty all the time because that does not challenge the status quo. That keeps everything exactly as it is because people who feel guilty do not stand up for themselves. People who are angry stand up for themselves. People who are angry sue their employers. They run for office. They start businesses. They lobby politicians. They advocate for better workplace policies. You don't necessarily want to dwell in anger, but it can be highly motivating towards action. So I want to live in a world where instead of mothers feeling guilty all the time, we live in a world where mothers are starting to get angry about what it is that we face. And, you know, anger is a complicated emotion, though. There's a lot of cultural baggage. There's racial issues. A lot of times people have issues with how they've been raised around anger and see it very, you know, it's very painful or difficult emotion. But I think there's a lot of power in it as a way to move forward and for mothers to be allowed to express that. Because as a society, that's kind of scary, the idea of mothers expressing anger.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and that's Catherine Goldstein, host of The Double Shift, a podcast about the next generation of working mothers. We teamed up for a live event at the Beta Brand Podcast Theater in San Francisco, and we were joined by Hana Baba, the host of an award-winning news show on KALW in San Francisco and co-host of The Stoop, a podcast about being Black in America. Hana is the mother of two teenagers and is Sudanese-American.
I think it's tricky for a Black woman to get angry. I think it's tricky for a Muslim woman to get angry. I think, you know, a lot of people with immigrant backgrounds are taught to kind of just like head down, do your work. If something happens that makes you angry, that's okay. Just move it along, move it along. But also, there, you run the risk of, you know, there's the angry Black woman stereotype, right? You run the risk of people being afraid of me because I'm a Muslim woman. So I have to be very careful when I express myself, and that's just the way it is. So I think this idea about anger might vary depending on where you come from, who you are, and privilege definitely plays a big role in it, I think. Like, some people just aren't allowed to be angry.
No, I think all of that, I think, makes the topic of anger so rich, but also so interesting to explore as an emotion for mothers. And
I want to get angry.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's times when I did not stand up for my child in the playground. And that haunts me. Sorry. Until this day. My daughter was very young, and I feel like I didn't speak up because of a perception that maybe was going to happen, that I just didn't want to get into any of that. So, it's complicated.
It's complicated. And I think there's a lot to sort of unpack and also to challenge our ideas about guilt, I think, is very powerful because we're so comfortable with guilt just hanging over us.
Mm. Sorry for, yeah.
No. And I'm just sitting here thinking, like, you probably felt guilty that you didn't stand up and get angry.
Sure.
Like, it's like this never-ending cycle.
Yeah, I'm talking about something that happened 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And I still have nightmares about it. And I still wonder why I didn't do that.
Have you come up with the perfect response by now? Like, if you were to run into that situation again?
Yeah. I mean, I've grown. I'm a different person now, but... You know, at the time, I did have this kind of, what will people think about me if I speak up, you know?
This is Inflection Point. Today's episode is from a live taping of the San Francisco stop on the Double Shift podcast, Fuck Mom Guilt World Tour. Here's the host of the Double Shift, Kathryn Goldstein.
So you've got three moms up here. We're all journalists. We all host podcasts. We all ask people questions for a living. So we're going to, and we all have our own unique experiences in our identities as working moms. So this isn't going to be a typical Q&A. It's more of a freewheeling roundtable where we're going to all be sharing and chiming in and asking each other questions.
Okay, so my first question is for you, Kathryn. You've done a few of these events now. This is your Bay Area section of your tour. So what was the inspiration behind the Fuck Mom Guilt World Tour?
Yes. So to start, I want to share a little bit of my own story, and that also goes into why I started the Double Shift podcast. So I had a very successful, hard-charging New York City media career, and then I knew I wanted to be a mom, and I thought motherhood would be nothing that I couldn't handle because everything up to that point had gone pretty well in my life and career. So when my son was born, I had a rough start to motherhood. My son was born with some serious health problems. He's doing great now, but it was a pretty traumatic start to the beginning of my life as a mother. And then I lost my job when he turned 6 months old. So the combination of those two big life events really had me sort of back on my heels and sort of questioning everything about who I was as a person, my identity, my value as a worker. And I also, you know, I kind of felt like everyone must have this working mom thing figured out except for me, and I was just a personal failure. But then as I started to ask more journalistic questions about working motherhood and starting to talk to more working moms and doing more research and reporting, I realized nobody had this all figured out, and so many of us felt like failures. And so as I started to do more research and reporting, we have this feeling that so many mothers feel like failures, and yet the realities that we face as mothers are pretty tough. We're socially and economically marginalized in many ways. A woman, if she has a baby between the ages of 25 and 35, her earnings never recover. And we live in a country where 25% of women go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. So we live in a country that really devalues mothers and gives us so little support and has so little societal support, public policy support, family support, and yet we all feel like failures, and we all feel personally bad that we've done something wrong. And so I started to notice that most of the media aimed at mothers really never talked about these things and didn't really do much investigative or hard-hitting or critical journalism. It was usually like the journalism aimed at mothers is really about tips and tricks and how if we got up at 5 a.m., then everything would be better. And that's all we needed to do. Or if we employed this genius lunch packing strategy, our lives would work. And that's just, there's no lunch packing strategy that's going to fix the situation for mothers in America. So I created the Double Shift because I wanted to tell much more compelling journalistic stories. And in our first season, we've gone across the country to tell stories you really haven't heard before. And part of that is to do the real journalism, but also I wanted to do this tour because I wanted to bring people together in community. Because it's one thing to hear a podcast, but it's another thing to truly connect with people and meet people together and come together over shared experience. So the Fuck Mom Guilt World Tour is just one way to do that.
I love it. And I also want to comment that I'm not getting up at 5 a.m. ever, like unless I have to make a plane. And I have to confess that, so I'm going to tell more of the story in a second, but I actually am on video telling moms what a lunch packing strategy could look like for a client of mine for marketing. Now I feel guilty.
This is a guilt-free zone, Lauren. Guilt-free zone. So I've shared a bit about my inspiration for the show and the tour, and I want to hear a bit from these two wonderful women on stage with me, and about what has formed you as working mothers, and you know, what are some of those moments that have really formed your experience. So we're going to start with you, Lauren.
Okay. So I, too, was a hard-charging executive in New York City working for an advertising firm before we moved out to San Francisco, where I continued doing the same thing. And it was right on the heels of the dot-com bubble and then burst. And so I was doing a lot of work in tech. And when that went away, our agency was looking for all kinds of clients. And we had the opportunity to go back to New York City and pitch Breck Shampoo. If anyone is familiar with the Breck, okay, so it got bought by the owners, the people who then acquired, who previously acquired Ovaltine. So they were just like bringing these brands back from the dead. And so we flew to New York. It was September 11th, 2001. And we're sitting in a meeting and we're waiting for this client to show up. And he is so freaking late. And we kept hearing he's in traffic. And we're like, you know, our happy space was just like getting smaller and smaller. And somebody opened the door, walked in the room, and called out one of the founders who came back and said, well, our client's not going to be able to make it. He's stuck in traffic. They've shut down downtown Manhattan because a plane has flown into the World Trade Center. And we were like, what the fuck? Like a plane? What, like, why would a plane fly into the World Trade Center? That's so weird. So we walked outside and we looked down the street and then we saw the second plane fly into the second building. And so at that time, my husband, who is sitting here with us right now, and I had been together for 10 years, and we knew that kids were in the future, but they had never had, I'd kind of said, like, by 35, I want to have kids. And I was 31 at this time. And so I called him, I told him we were okay, and then I came home, and you can verify if this is really true, but this is how I remember it. I was like, let's make some babies. So, so something about this 9/11 experience made me want to procreate. So that's one thing. And then we had to figure it out. So we dropped the goalie in January and we had a baby in January of 2003. So we were on a mission and we made that mission happen. But then all of a sudden I had to find a nanny and then I was working and I couldn't see my child.
So was part of that sort of inspiration was really like this sort of sense of fragility of your life or sort of like this witnessing this big event sort of made you reevaluate your priorities?
I think it was like, wow, time is precious and we can take nothing for granted. And I knew that it was something that I wanted to do and I kept being in the distance because I loved my work. And I, you know, I loved working late and I loved not having to worry about what time I came home. And I had a wonderful, you know, boyfriend / husband. I guess you were my husband by then, who was, you know, also working and that worked great for us. Yeah, so the idea to have babies. And then once we had one, we decided we'd have two. And eventually I worked for, I'll just fast forward for the sake of time, but I got out of advertising and I started working for a health and wellness startup. And this was now in the midst of the financial crisis. And they asked me if I would go half-time. And at this moment, we had a nanny and that was great, but I was feeling lots of guilt about the nanny, spending more time with my children than I did. And they asked if I would go half-time so they could save money. And I, before the sentence had even come out of the CEO's mouth, I was like, yes, 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 I will do that. And then shortly after, the whole company went out of business. And so did my husband's company. So now here we were with two children, a nanny who, you know, we were kind of committed to paying a mortgage, and, you know, no jobs. So that totally changed the face of the way that we thought about how we were running our lives. I started freelancing, and I've been freelancing ever since, and that has given me a ton of flexibility for being with my kids. So if there's any silver lining to that crazy time, that's how it worked out. So,
Hannah, something I think often gets overlooked in our discussions about how we see ourselves as working mothers is our own relationship to our own mothers and what has been modeled for us. So tell me a little bit about your own mother and how that has shaped you as a working mother.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing I think about a lot of children of immigration. My family came from Sudan, and my family's been here since the 70s. They brought me here as a baby. So, but there's always this feet in two worlds, feet in two cultures, right? And so my mother, Sudan is one of the countries where, you know, we had the first woman judge in the 60s. We had the first woman this and parliamentarian. Girls' education is focused on, and so my mom and dad met in college, for example, and so she was working when she was married. When she had me, there was an expectation for her to stay at home, and especially moving to this new land called America, where everybody's different. You need to be close to your children when they're young and teach them, you know, your language and your values and all of the kind of fears that come with immigration, I think. So she stayed at home and had my next brother, 1, 2, 3. In my culture, they say never count the number of people because it's superstitious. I shouldn't be doing this. But a number of brothers. A number of brothers. And she was at home. And for me, that's what I was used to. When I grew up, got married, I thought differently. I felt like I wanted to continue working when my children were young, and then maybe let go a little bit and start maybe freelancing, doing something like that as they came into their teen years. Because me growing up here in the US, I think my teen years were, you know, a time that was, for everybody really, you know, a time when you're sensitive, a time when you're hearing all of this messaging around you. But for us, it was really, we were isolated. We were not in a very diverse Houston, Texas in the 80s. Not a lot of people looked like us. Definitely not Muslims. My mom wore the headscarf. I got teased all the time. And so, you know, it was like you go home and there's an environment that's very Sudan, that's very, we're speaking Arabic, we're eating the Sudanese food, we're doing this, and you go outside to school and it's a totally different experience. But growing up and becoming a teenager, I remember when I first kind of did this to my parents, right, and looked at them in the eye and talked back, something happened to them at that point where they were like, okay, we need to, you know, do something. When we actually moved back to Sudan, they picked up and moved back to Sudan. And I believe it was after the day I did this and said, why can't I have a boyfriend like Jennifer?
With your hand on your hip.
I believe that with all my heart, put my hand on my hip, and the looking them in the eye and being sassy. And that for them culturally, they were not having that. And so at that point, we moved back to Sudan. I lived kind of my formative years there. We lived next to my grandma's house, which was extremely formative. It was like Grand Central Station. Aunts and uncles coming through all the time, just like for random reasons. Somebody's bringing food to share. Somebody's bringing their, you know, new dress to show us, whatever. I loved it. I just absorbed all of it. I loved the culture. I loved the food. I loved the language. And I came back later, actually, as an adult, and then had my own children. Having my own children, I had to work at the beginning of my first born child's life because just money. I was marrying a resident who was in his second year of residency. We all know what kind of money that is. Anyway, so I started working. I put my daughter in daycare when she was 4 months old. And of course the guilt, and of course the cultural also burden of, why would you let somebody else raise your child? Why would you let somebody else? And I was getting phone calls from aunties from Sudan, and being just like, but how is she gonna learn Arabic? And how is she gonna do this? And how? And so it's like you have to deal with the mom guilt of America, because I was also on the blogs of that time, and what is it called? Baby Center?
Oh, God.
Girl, Baby Center with the working mom versus non-working mom wars. And that was kind of just the American side of the struggle. And then I would get the calls from Sudan of just like, you need to be at home. with your child. And so for me, I think it's just different because of that immigrant background, but having an understanding husband as well, I think is crucial, having that partner that will support you no matter what you do. And I'm looking at you, yeah. Lauren's Yay, better half, is important, especially when you have a whole other culture you're kind of like pushing up against. And so I realized that I was doing something very different from my mom, but that was okay.
Something you said a moment ago about wanting to really be sort of continue with your career when your kids were young and thinking about stepping back in the middle school years, which or early teen years, which you are now. I don't hear about that as much because I'm in a phase with a younger child and I know a lot of people with younger children and we really feel like if we just get them to preschool, everything's going to be great. Like we just think that the baby phase is the hardest phase. How do you think about your career at this moment when you things are going really well and you're thinking about, was this a time you were going to step back?
Yeah, I mean, it's a time now. It's interesting. It's a time when I don't have to worry about a lot of things, right, in terms of can they do this on their own, right, or can they stay home alone and, you know, me and my husband can go out for a dinner or whatever. But then because this is their teenage years and, again, their formative years, I feel the burden of just trying to instill in them values that I learned. And, you know, this is a time when they're very sensitive. This is a time when they're thinking about identity a lot. And so we talk about this a lot on our podcast, The Stoop, where, like, who am I? What am I? And how do I fit into this society? And we live in the Bay Area for a very specific reason, because it is so diverse. And because you can kind of define yourself here, is what I felt. So they are at a time when I do feel like I can let go a little bit, but at the same time, I'm even more in their business. Mm-hmm. And I'm even more kind of just like coming into the room and just like laying down and, so what happened with so-and-so today? I know all the gossip. I know all the tea from school. And some of it is like, I don't want to, you know, just like part of me doesn't really want to hear it, but I force myself to hear it because, you know, they need me at this time. I feel more than they needed me when they were toddlers and when they were little, which sounds weird.
It sounds so overwhelming to me.
I don't know. It's just,
next level challenges.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, especially the identity stuff. And they are living at a time now where this, you know, this is talked about a lot. It's part of their daily conversations at school with their friends on social media, the whole who am I, what do I stand for, what am I not, who am I allowed to be, who do, you know, and that's some deep-ish. I know I'm allowed to curse, right?
Do it's it. Called fuck mom
oh,
guilt.
Right, right.
You can only say fuck, so.
And, you know, for me, it's like, it's harder than the work that I was doing at the beginning in their babyhood and their toddlerhood when they were small children. Like, I feel like this is the harder work that maybe I need to be more available for.
Lauren, you also have teenagers, so I would love you to weigh in a little bit about this. And also this question of, like, are, you know, people, sometimes people feel like they need to step back, and our society doesn't always support that idea, or maybe never supports that idea. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
So, in preparing for this conversation, I was curious what the stats were on caregiving and how much time we spend and what it's actually costing us as a country. And, so setting the teen question to one side for a second, I just thought it was worth just putting this out there. So what I learned doing my research is that women represent 75% of all caregivers. And people, this kind of blew me away, actually. People caring for a child under 18 spend almost 30 hours per week performing caregiving tasks. I mean, that's like a full-time freaking job. Like, the average job is 40 hours a week, so I don't really understand how those two things intersect, but that is what the numbers say. So, but the most astounding thing that I found is that as a country, we do not give caregiving any value. We don't consider it in our GDP. Like, it is not a way that we measure how successful we are as a country is how much care we give. But if you were to put a number to it, the annual dollar value of unpaid care in a year is equivalent to the revenue of Walmart, almost $470 billion a year in unpaid caregiving.
Yes, we actually, the Double Shift has explored this. We created an invisible labor calculator where you can tally how much your labor that you're not being paid for is worth, just to put a dollar amount on this. I think this is like such an important feminist issue that needs to continue to be addressed, because it's astounding how much work most men and women, but largely women, do that's unpaid and undervalued.
And what did you count? So like taking the kid to school, bring them back.
Yeah, so it's like, so in the labor calculator, like childcare is one thing, but driving kids to events or scheduling doctor's appointments or gardening or pet care or, you know, doing medical forms, like all those stuff, if you paid, so you outsourced it, it creates it's a huge amount of labor that takes, basically, that's how our society can keep going, is for people to do this labor, and it's sort of unacknowledged and certainly unpaid.
So I've kind of gamed the system, I'll say, which, because I can do so much of my work over the phone, when I'm walking the dog, I'll take a phone call. When I'm driving to pick someone up or take them, you know, or take them home, I'll do a phone call. Like, there's a lot of things that actually I can get paid for while I'm doing the, you know, the unpaid stuff. And it's a much bigger hourly rate than I would, you know, pay a driver or whatever. So I justify it that way. But anyway, so when you get to the teenage years, you think that, like, okay, you get them into school, suddenly you have all this free time. You know, you don't have to take care of them as much. And having a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old, I feel like they need me just as much as they ever did, but just in totally different ways, and in ways that they would never necessarily, you know, ask me for. Or if they do ask me for it.
Or acknowledge.
Or acknowledge, right. Yeah. It's a different ask, but the time is still the same.
Right.
You know?
And so it becomes increasingly hard. So even in these years, like, there's not a way that's well accepted in our society for women to take a few years off at a potentially a very, sort of like, all times of your career are delicate times, you know? So if you take time off in your 30s when you have kids, or you take time off in your 40s when they're older, those are all sort of adds up to these wage gaps that we find.
Yeah.
And these fact that women's earnings never recover. So these are all the social forces at play behind some of those numbers I talked about in the beginning.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, this applies to the gig economy, not just freelancers. I mean, when I say freelance, I'm talking about, I do marketing strategy as well as doing Inflection Point. That's where I get paid by the hour, not Inflection Point, just FYI. But I am often having to ask myself, do I want to earn money or do I want to spend time with my child? Like, it's actually
as blatant as that.
Yes, I have to prioritize. Right. Do I want to earn money right now or do I want to spend time with my child? And that sucks. I mean, that is like the weirdest way to have to think about your life, you know? And in the end, I'm just like, it's not actual money. It's could have been.
Right.
And I don't, you know, the priority is usually lean toward the kid, but sometimes I've got my back to them while I'm on the computer, you know? Coming up next, we're going to change gears a little bit and talk about the mental load. You can get something off your mental checklist, and that's to subscribe to Inflection Point. And while you're at it, support the show with a contribution. And then you don't have to feel guilty for listening for free. BRB with the Fuck Mom Guilt World Tour. My kid hates it when I say that. We're back and bringing you the live show I co-hosted with Catherine Goldstein of The Double Shift and our guest Hana Baba of KALW and The Stoop podcast. Here's Catherine.
So I want to switch gears here and share a clip from our first season, from an episode 3, called The Candidate Who Carpools. And this is about Ashton Clemens, who was a mom with 3 little kids who decided to run for office in North Carolina. And I spent the day following her around, going between picking up her kids at school and going to campaign events, and we sat down to do our big interview. And about halfway through, her babysitter came home with her twin sons, And we realized her daughter, Letty, she realized her daughter, Letty, was not with the babysitter, and the babysitter was supposed to have picked her up at ballet. So we're in the middle of our sit-down interview, and Ashton realizes her daughter has been left at ballet while she's sitting here with this journalist recording everything. So she has to get up and, you know, call the ballet studio and send the babysitter back to get her. And it was a very, like, real-life moment. And this is what it's like if you're running for office with little kids and you have all these complex logistics. So... After this all happened, I'm like, when I'm there with her, we're like trying to get the mic really close so we can get all the drama really up close. But I felt like a very real moment, and I heard a lot from listeners about how real this moment felt. So we're going to listen to a little clip where we then talk about what happened in this moment.
All the logistics of the family that we just witnessed, like, that sort of reminded me this idea that even when both parents are so involved, so often it's the mother who has the mental checklist.
Oh, yeah.
About everything. Like, you knew immediately as she walked in, like, where's Letty? She's supposed to be with you. Like, you didn't miss a beat. What has been your experience with the mental checklist now that you're running for office?
I think it's just more. I mean, there's just more on the checklist, and it's less routine.
Do you feel like you can offload the checklist, or is the checklist always with you?
No. Can any woman offload the checklist? I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I wish I could. And I think that's a major difference in my husband and I. And you know, I think he figures it out for sure. It doesn't occupy this part of his brain in the way it does mine. And he doesn't own it in the same way. You know, like, I'm the one sending the email, he's responding, then I'm getting the babysitters and, you know, doing all of those pieces. And it's not to say he doesn't do a whole lot. He does. It is different, though, I think.
So, first off, Hannah and Lauren, what's on your mental checklist right now?
Well, in addition to remembering to pay the homeowner's insurance, I actually have this like never-ending burden of worrying about like the future for my daughters. That is on my mental checklist.
That's
like
a heavy list.
Fix the future.
I don't know when you get to cross that thing off your mental checklist. Hana, what's on your mental checklist?
My mental checklist. Tomorrow, my daughter's supposed to get braces, but 10:30 won't work, so we have to reschedule it to another time.
Yeah, okay, yes.
What's on yours, Catherine?
That we need to set up an automatic payment for my son's preschool, and I'm worried that I'm going to forget when I get back to North Carolina. I want to ask Lauren and Hannah a version of the question I asked Ashton, which is, do you think any mother can offload the checklist? Is this something that we can do? Hannah?
I offload parts of the checklist all the time. My husband steps up immediately when he feels like I'm overwhelmed. He knows when I'm overwhelmed, he can tell. Not because he's a psychiatrist, but...
Is he a psychiatrist? Because
we're just very close. He is a psychiatrist.
That might help. But,
you know, I feel... And I immediately say yes. I've learned at the beginning of our marriage, and especially when we started having children, this was harder to kind of let go. It's just like, she's not going to do it right. I have to do it by myself. And still, you know, like, what was it the other day? Just like laundry detergent, right? Get this one, please. I even like took a picture of it and sent it to him.
Right.
And he still got the wrong one. And a mop. Same thing. I took a picture the other day. Right. I'm sorry to do this to you. I'm outing you in front of everybody in the podcast. But, you know, he tries and it's fine. And I've learned to let go a little bit. You know, especially of the things like that, right? Just like the shopping isn't right. You know, he picked up the daughter a little late. I'm starting to become more relaxed and flexible. I think it has to do with they're older and we're thinking about bigger picture things,
right?
College and identity and all these like existential philosophical things that seem to be much more worthy of my worry and my brain than... the tide with bleach.
Right. So letting go of the tide of bleach because you're worried about the larger existential questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, Lauren.
I just want to comment on what you just said, which is like you're still in charge of the checklist.
I am.
Yeah. You, yes.
So can the mother off? You still have the checklist, even though you have a supportive partner who is helping. He is helping with
He's
the checklist.
Helping.
But he will say, for example, is there salad? Do I need to bring the salad? Some salad stuff.
Right.
Maybe I didn't have that in my mind. I don't know if that's important, but you know, it's a thing.
Yeah.
It's good. Check one. The lettuce. Remembering the lettuce.
Yes.
Fiber. Lettuce. It's so important.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what the question is anymore. Okay. Can I let it go? Can I let the mental checklist go? I am like.
Or can any mother?
Can any mother? Yeah, I'm sure some mothers can, but I can't. I am like this crazy to-do list maker, and it's like in my head, and it's on paper, and like, no, I can never let it go, even with an amazing supportive husband who's like telling me things that need to go on the list. So I'm not the only one coming up with the items.
So I'm semi-obsessed with this idea of the mental checklist and the mental load, and I have been reading books about it all summer because I'm so cool. That's how I spent my summer, reading books about the mental load and the checklist. And basically, I do think mothers can let go of the mental checklist. I think we are socially conditioned to feel like it's our responsibility because we are so deeply judged when things fall off the checklist. Like, nobody judges a father if the kid's socks are dirty, and nobody judges a father if the school permission form isn't turned in on time. All that judgment comes to the mother.
Or if the hair is messy.
Nobody's calling, nobody's gossiping about the father.
No, it's me.
Yeah.
I mean, us, women.
Yeah.
You have a great episode on this on The Stoop. I just want to refer people to go listen to it. Listen to that one.
It's hard.
So good.
The struggle is real.
But so some of the things that I have like learned from my summer reading is basically like, one, like I think there's some very good strategies with like very detailed spreadsheets that are like really delegated and like not, if someone doesn't do their job, you don't rescue them. You just make the spreadsheet and it's their responsibility and you don't think about it. Like that's the actual like practical strategy I've read about that's interesting. I think that goes to a lot of issues with renegotiating partnerships. Like I think anytime you have a child, your partnership, if you're in a partnership, is renegotiated on some level. And then the third part is like truly just not giving a fuck what people think about you. Like that is like the ultimate key to getting rid of the mental checklist is just like, is that.
That's a hard one that last
No, week. It's totally hard. And that's because especially as mothers, we're so socially conditioned to feel that judgment and be sensitive to that judgment. And so I think that, but that not giving a fuck, like my quick personal example is that kids' birthday parties are like the bane of my existence. And planning to get the kid that we're going to's birthday gift on time and wrapping it and like I'll do it and my husband usually takes them to the party and then he forgets to give the gift. I do all this work to make it, get the gift and wrap it and he doesn't even drop it off at the table. It's like still in the bag. And then so I just decided like we don't do birthday gifts. Like I'm just like this is not worth the amount of energy this is taking. So our kid, he doesn't care. He doesn't care that he brings the kid to the birthday party and all the other parents have brought gifts and we don't bring a gift. Like, he's impervious to whatever side eye is going on. And I just accept that. And then maybe they're all thinking like, wow, Catherine didn't get a gift. And so in return, we don't get any kids' birthday gifts. And in return, we do no gift birthday parties. And like, it's gone. It's off the list. I never have to think about birthday gifts again. So that's like my own little mental checklist, you know, release and finding those little things in your life that you can just say, fuck it.
I think also surrounding yourself with people who are not judgmental either.
Yeah, totally.
The people around you, that's so important.
Totally.
Yeah. I kind of have to ask you, have you asked any, like, do you ever ask your husband, like, do you have a mental checklist? Like, if you asked any of the, I don't know, guys in the room, do you have a mental checklist? Yes, we got a nod. We've got a small, well, 6-inch. Okay, so yeah, we carry it.
Right.
Based on a sample size of 2. No checklist. I am curious, Catherine, where you're seeing some bright spots or movement for working mothers, this new generation of working mothers.
So, you know, sometimes people ask me, is there anything that makes you hopeful? And I think everything makes me hopeful. I'm very hopeful. I could not get up every day and like dedicate my life to telling stories of working mothers if I was not hopeful about what is coming and what I see and what is happening. So basically, I think the thing that makes me the most hopeful is that People are sharing their stories and speaking up for themselves in new ways. And I think we're in a cultural moment where we're listening to all kinds of women's stories and women's voices in a way and taking them seriously in a way that we haven't before as a culture. And so I truly believe things are getting better and will continue to get better for working mothers. And the reason that I make the double shift is because I just want to be a part of that.
That was Catherine Goldstein, Hana Baba, and me at the Bay Area live taping of Catherine's F Mom Guilt World Tour. Thank you so much for joining us. I'll put links to Catherine's podcast, The Double Shift, and Hana's podcast, The Stoop, on my website at inflectionpointradio.org. I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point, and this is how women rise up. See you next time. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, Pandora, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, support our production with a monthly or one-time contribution and keep women's stories front and center. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at L.A. Schiller. To find out more about the guests you heard today and to sign up for our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.